You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
I'm not much for scary movies, so when I went to see the 2011 film Contagion starring Gwyneth Paltrow, I didn't expect to be as terrified as I was. A simple dinner in a faraway land leads to a worldwide disease pandemic that makes the 2014 Ebola outbreak look like a mild flu season. It would be comforting to think that it was not just a movie. It could never happen in real life. Sadly, viral diseases that affect our pets, think canine influenza, our dinner, avian influenza, and our lives, SARS and mad cow disease, are too commonly featured on the nightly news. How can you stop something that's smaller than a bacteria and antibiotics are helpless against? My guest, Dr. Jonna Mazet, director of the One Health Institute at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, will tell us how veterinarians have partnered with doctors, governments, health workers, and hunters to protect the health of all of us. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Listen, cat people, it's just litter. Until you realize those big boxes mean big smells, big messes, and big money. Switch to World's Best Cat Litter, the only litter with concentrated power. It guarantees less smells, less work, all with less litter. Try the small bag that lasts one cat 30 days and you'll realize it's just litter, unless it's World's Best Cat Litter. Find it at Target, Walmart, and at your local grocery and pet stores.
Amazing Pet Expos is coming to a city near you. Admission is always free, and your pet is welcome. Shopping, adoptions, free nail trims, discounted shots and microchipping, agility, a pet costume contest, and much more. Plus, meet the guys from Animal Planet's hit TV series Tank and Pit Boss. Online at AmazingPetExpos.com.
Bring your pets to the Pet Expo.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Mazet, thank you so much for being with us. I know to get you in one place at one time is pretty much amazing. You're always on the go.
Thank you for having me. We're really excited to be able to talk to you and all of your audience today.
Well, number one, people hear me speaking on The Pet Doctor about this One Health approach. What is it?
Well, here at UC Davis, we think of the One Health approach as having two major tenets. And the first one is that we need to bring together all of the smart and willing people with the different disciplines that they have to really solve problems. So instead of going into our laboratories and working alone, we pull together in a more holistic approach to be able to solve global problems. So that's the first tenet, is that collaboration. The second tenet is that we consider holistically animals, people, and the environment, and how their health are inextricably linked. So here at the One Health Institute, we work on global problem solving at that interface where animal, people, and environmental health is all critical to each other.
So it really is a danger if people, even medical professionals, think, okay, I am a veterinarian, I just treat animals. Well, I'm a physician, I just treat people. We really do have to talk to each other, don't we?
Exactly, we do. And more, movies like Contagion, as you mentioned, or the news makes us aware of that. But I would say even as few as 5 years ago, the general public, especially here in the U.S., where we're sort of separated from the idea that animal health is really connected to our health because we buy our chickens already shrink-wrapped in the grocery store and we don't think of them as actually the bird walking around in the barnyard, we tend to forget that we are very connected and that the environment that affects those chickens is also affecting us in a similar way. So it's critical to start coming together and thinking about those linkages and getting sort of upstream of these problems. And I guess the goal for what we're doing here with One Health and I think the One Health that's being practiced around the world, the approach, is to not be reacting to those problems. Like the list that you mentioned is perfect when we think about avian influenza and canine influenza and SARS and MERS or Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. We don't want those to happen. So if we want to prevent them, we have to think upstream or we have to think about what drove the situation to allow those diseases to spill over. And that's what we're really trying to do as through the One Health movement.
I know it was very interesting. It just really brought it home to me. People listening to this probably have heard of the canine influenza outbreak that occurred in Chicago. And at my practice, we were used to give the canine influenza vaccine and said, boy, we're just not seeing this. We're going to stop giving it because it's just not here. We just don't see it as a problem. And as soon as we stopped, it was like the following day, we hear about this outbreak. It's like, oh my goodness, what is so different about this? And so I understand this was a canine influenza and had been previously seen in China, Korea, and other places, I think in Thailand. How do you think it got to the United States? Was that just some little dog that somebody put on a plane and it came?
Well, that's possible. I think it, you know, I'm not an expert in how the canine influenza is moving around the world, but there are different ideas about how that could happen. One is simply, many of you know that are international travelers, that your baggage and your hand carry-ons are inspected and sniffed by lots of really cute dogs that are helping to protect our agricultural system as well as, you know, our general health, if you think about drug dogs and all of those things. So they have to sniff everything that comes across international borders. So there is an idea that potentially they could sniff, obviously, viruses. That's how we catch flu from each other, right? We sniff something that someone else is coughing or sneezing out. So that's a possibility. It's maybe more likely that these animals were, that a dog was transported from Asia who had been exposed in another way. It's been suggested in a live animal market. So in Asia, instead of the shrink-wrapped chicken, as I mentioned, we see much more commonly these live animal markets where people will go and pick out their dinner while it's still alive. And there's often lots of dogs running around and, unfortunately, lots of stray dogs running around. So people do rescue efforts in those areas, and those animals might get moved around to where people are willing to adopt them. And that happens to be here quite a bit.
Dr. Mizet, again, I think it's amazing that you're in one place at one time long enough for this interview because you are constantly traveling to these hotspots. How did you become involved with this interest in emerging infectious diseases?
Well, you know, I think actually my evolution towards this working on things like Ebola and influenza and MERS around the world really came to me through the animals. So I am a veterinarian, and I started out my career and continue to be at heart a wildlife veterinarian. And right here at home in California, I was working with a collaborative team to try and help figure out what was killing the California sea otter and figure out how we could help them. And by doing that, it became increasingly obvious that they were catching diseases that they shouldn't be catching. They were frankly catching diseases that were running off from shore because of people's activities on shore and running off to the sea. And they were naive, just like the Native Americans were naive to the diseases that the Europeans brought over. The sea otters were naive to things that were running off from the shore from human activities, including having pets and letting our pets pets be outside and do the things that pets do outside. So it became obvious to me that the connection, if I wanted to save the sea otter, I needed to be thinking about what people were doing. And then that brought me around for full circle to think about environmental problems that we were having, like runoff from coastal communities, and all the way back around to what does that mean for us? Because sea otters, if you don't know, love sushi, the same exact sushi that I love, especially some of the better sushi, like abalone and things. And so we wanted to look at their food. And that brought us around to them being a great sentinel for our health, both our impacts on the coastal environment, but also those resources we share, our food that we share, and how that could make a difference to the health of my children. So that's how I got interested, and it sort of blossomed from there. At the same time, around the country and around the world, the One Health approach was really starting to become obvious to lots of people working in my profession on global health problems, and it sort of started, a movement got started that we needed to do these things better, and that brought us to some of the most important issues. Of course, for me, sea otter health was one of the most important issues, but I think if you ask the general public, things like protecting ourselves from infectious diseases that could, you know, have huge epidemic and pandemic effects rises way up there on the list.
These emerging diseases, I remember as a child, you know, you heard about the flu season and that was about it, but you didn't hear about these outbreaks that are just killing thousands upon thousands of people, and it seems as though, you know, SARS, we never heard of before. Are there just more diseases? Are there more viruses? Why do you think we're hearing about it more now than we ever did before? Is it just because we're looking?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think the data isn't good. We want to know if there are more diseases, and all evidence that we can pull together tells us that there are more emerging infectious diseases. But boy, are we ever technologically better at detecting them now than we ever have been before in history. So that's a tangled web to sort of decipher, is to say, are they really on the increase because of the way that we are occupying the earth, or are we just better at picking them up? I think it's a combination, but the evidence, when we try to control for that knowledge of how much better we are at detecting them, it looks like they are on the increase. And that's why we really, again, I use this term, it's a little bit strange, but this upstream term, we want to understand what's happening upstream from you and I getting sick. We want to understand so that we can start to make changes in how we treat animals and how we treat the environment so that we don't have these spillover events. When we have the spillover events, some of those end up making lots of people sick or starting an epidemic. And so that's what we really want to prevent. And we can do that by understanding better what's out there. So what kind of infectious agents are out there? I specifically work more on viruses than anything else. But once we understand what's out there, we can protect ourselves and we can start to think about our behavior and change that behavior to make the world a healthier place.
Dr. Mazet, being the director of the One Health Institute at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about viruses and diseases is just second nature to you. But probably some of the people listening are going, what is a virus? And why don't antibiotics work on it? If you could answer that, what's a virus?
So a virus is an organism, like we're organisms and like bacteria are organisms, but it's quite a bit different. It's more primitive kind of organism. And it's just like you and I are not the same as a bacteria. You know, if you want to prevent a bacterial disease or stop a bacterial disease, we need treatments that work specifically on that bacterial disease. Viruses have been tougher for us to treat and tougher for us to discover how we prevent and then stop them. So I think it's more a medical sort of evolution that we worked on bacteria first because we had discovery in the area of bacteria that allowed us to get to treatments. Now, as viruses become more and more of a priority in the awareness of the medical community as well as awareness of the general public, we're seeing rapid development in the treatment and prevention. I think specifically we've been better at preventing through vaccines. So many vaccines are targeted at viruses, but our treatment, as most people people know is not as good. So people have heard of Tamiflu and the treatments for herpes virus, for example. Those are relatively new in our therapeutic regimes in veterinary medicine and human medicine. So I anticipate we'll see a great increase in those treatments being available. And you mentioned the vaccines for canine flu earlier. We need to think about how we use vaccines and when they are useful and when they aren't, and maybe start to develop better and better vaccines as well. So we have a lot of options, but yeah, I think viruses are a little bit newer. They're not new, right? We've known about the flu for a long, long time, but we haven't really understand how they work and how we can treat them. So that's a new area of development.
Dr. Mazzetta, it's oftentimes clients will come in with their sick pet saying, oh, you know, I just had the flu and now my pet is sick. Did I give my disease to my pet? Or vice versa. Sometimes, oh, you know, my dog is sick. Am I going to get this? I have a baby at home. Do I have to be concerned? And I would say the majority of the time, viruses are not jumping from one species to another. But there is, as you're saying, this interface of people out there, especially in many of these countries where there is constant interface with them, the wildlife, and that's what they're eating, and the rodents are coming into their homes and such, much more so than we have here in the United States. Because of all this, I know you are part of a group called PREDICT. PREDICT is trying to keep us from that upstream problem. What is PREDICT?
So PREDICT is a project that we lead here at UC Davis. It's funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, and it's operated by a consortium of great people all over the world. So right now we're engaging in 31 countries, which includes the governments of all of those countries and our partners in those countries, as well as groups like the Wildlife Conservation Society, EcoHealth Alliance, a group called Metabiota here in San Francisco, and the Smithsonian Institution. We pull together as a consortium to work, as I mentioned, with all those disciplines, health professionals, as well as economists and sociologists and anthropologists, to identify viral threats, so things that could spill over from animals to people or people to animals. And then we go out and we look for those viruses. To look for them, we have to train people to be safe so that they're handling the potential hosts, which in this case, we're thinking about wildlife hosts of these viruses, safely, and they protect the wildlife while they sample them, and then also are being safe for themselves. Then they have to get those samples into the laboratory and test for these new viruses, and that's super hard. So we're really, really proud that we've been able to, in just the last 5 years, handle about 56,000 animals, wild animals primarily, as well as people, not handle them, but test them in areas where they're working closely with these animals to detect 1,000 viruses. And most of those viruses, about 900 of those 1,000 viruses that we've detected, are brand new to us in the scientific community. We've never detected them before. So we've more than doubled the number of known mammalian viruses in the world in just 5 years. We're not doing that to scare people like there's this huge viral pool that we never knew about. It's more to say, what's out there, and now let's rank them. Which ones should we be looking for? Which ones should be targets for these vaccines? Which ones should we think about for more surveillance so that we can watch for little blips before they get out of control, like Ebola got out of control in West Africa, and we're still responding to that outbreak. We've also, in that same group of people, found viruses and other diseases that are spilling over from people into endangered species like the mountain gorilla. And we've been able, through this process, to identify causes of death that we didn't expect in mountain gorillas coming from people. So it goes both ways, for the animals and for the people.
I'm chatting right now with Dr. Jonna Mazzetta. She is the director of the One Health Institute at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to take a short break and be right back. This is fascinating. Stay tuned.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Hi, Jill. I see you and Bella are enjoying this lovely day as well.
It's a perfect day for a walk. Isn't that right, Bella?
And what a colorful ID tag you have, Bella. It certainly puts my Rusty's boring engraved tag to shame.
Isn't it great? It's a dog tag art tag.
Dog tag art?
Yeah, dog tag art makes the world's coolest pet ID tags. Pick from hundreds of cute designs or upload your photos or artwork to create a unique tag of your own. They even give you 4 lines of text on the back of the tag for important contact information.
I love it! But do they hold up? We have to replace Rusty's metal tags so often because the information wears away.
Dog tag art tags are some of the highest quality pet tags out there. They're made with super durable stainless steel. Your information is always legible, and the tags are guaranteed for life.
Well, I'm sold. Where can I get my dog tag art tag for Rusty?
DogTagArt.com.
Sounds great! We can't wait to get online and get a tag of our own.
DogTagArt.com. We keep best friends together. Use the coupon code RADIO for a 25% discount off any tag.
There's nothing more delicious and healthy than an old family recipe. And for over 50 years, our family's been creating them especially for your pets. Nutrisource Super Premium Pet Foods. Dog and cat food that's all natural, holistic, and organic. Nutrisource Pet Foods contain our patented Good for Life system for your pet's optimum health and well-being. So, order now. Safe quality food made by our family for your furry family members. Go to NutrisourcePetFoods.com.
From our family to yours, KLN Family Brands.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Mazette, you're talking about doing testing, and I go to my lab here and I have testing done, and it's not inexpensive. And knowing that many of these countries don't have tremendous resources, and oftentimes as you're trying to find, you know, the patient zero before that outbreak really explodes and you just get that first, you know, couple of instances, how do you test on such a local level? That must be extremely difficult, very expensive.
Yeah, well, you've hit the big challenge on the head there, Bernadine. So it's even a bit of a bigger problem than that. The expense is an issue, but it's the lack of a platform on which to diagnose. So, you know, when your patients come in, or if I go into the hospital, we have to, as clinicians, we have to guess. Our best educated, really strongly based in science, but we still are making an educated guess based on the symptoms that our patients have as to what they may be exposed to and what may be causing their disease. So just like anybody else, we send that sample off to the lab and we check the boxes. Test for this, test for that, test for avian influenza, test for canine influenza, right? So there has to be a knowledge about what those diseases are for there to be a box to check on that laboratory form. What we're trying to do is to help figure out what boxes should be on there, because right now, if you have a rare disease that's never been diagnosed before and you go to the hospital, or you bring in your dog that may have just gotten a spillover event from a bat in your yard, there may not be a box to check for the disease that's affecting their health. So we're coming up with new platforms so that us as veterinarians and our clinicians for our own health when we go to the hospital don't need to absolutely have a box to check. We're trying to give better tools to our clinicians so that they can say, this looks different to me. Now, if it's something that you see all the time, an ear infection in a Labrador, or, you know, we don't need to guess because we're 90% or 99% sure of what's causing that and we can confirm our diagnosis. But when we see something really strange, we need better tools. We need better laboratories. I think what was amazing that we discovered through the PREDICT project is that we were working in areas, just like you said, that didn't have a lot of capacity, they didn't have a lot of equipment, and they didn't have a lot of money. So we had to figure out an inexpensive way to do this diagnosis of unknown diseases and to find unknown pathogens. And we were able to do that working with our consortium partners at Columbia University and the University of California, San Francisco, as well as our own UC Davis laboratory. We came up with an inexpensive way to look for the causes of mystery diseases.
So you don't have veterinarians out there in the field. There just can't be enough veterinarians, say, in a West African country to do all this. Who have you trained?
We absolutely have veterinarians out in the field. The veterinarians are some of our leaders of the project, and most of our country coordinators, our lead predict personnel for the countries around the world, are veterinarians. But you are right. We also have anthropologists that work on the human behavior side. We have physicians and public health practitioners that participate with us, and we have laboratorians. Then on the global piece, we have ecologists and economists that help us think about the trends and how things are moving around the world. But on the ground, we're working with governments. We work with the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of the Environment, and the Ministry of Health, and we bring their folks together, and we get them trained for their safety and then the safety of their human and animal patients. And once we have the safety piece handled, then we get them trained up to really do the surveillance in the field. We've seen dramatic changes in the way people respond to things like Ebola outbreaks that you didn't hear about that have been ongoing in DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, many other places in the last 5 years. But they were handled so well by these countries and the teams and our participants in those teams that it didn't make the news like West Africa because they didn't get out of control.
You were talking about getting out of control and people knowing about it. It would seem as though if I were the government official in a country that I'm already maybe economically strapped, somebody has just told me that there is disease outbreak that I know now nobody's going to want to fly into my country. They're not going to want me to have produce or products that are leaving the country for fear of a pandemic spread of disease. I might not really want to tell people about this. So how have you convinced government that it is for their best interest, for their populace best interest, to work with you? Because that seems like that would be a major challenge.
You know, I thought so too. And I think the key is being proactive. I think every country in the world right now is worried about emerging infectious diseases. And you're right. They often do not have the budget to put towards prevention or even detection of these potential threats. So first and foremost, everywhere we've been so far, the governments have been hugely welcoming. And it is kind of a U.S. health diplomacy effort to get out there and work with these countries and say, we want to help because it helps your country, but it also protects global health, which protects our country as well. So we are out there working with them. And I was pretty shocked when we started the project 5 years ago about how welcoming all these countries were. Now, part of being welcoming was that they had to agree that if we found something, that they would put that out in the public domain. So all the countries that we worked with in the first 5 years, we had 20 countries in our portfolio that we were partnering with. Now we have about 31. But every country that we've worked with in the past agreed in principle that this was an important problem and that they wanted our help to work on it together collaboratively, and agreed in advance that whatever we found, they would put out into the public domain. And I've been shocked at how compliant and communicative all the country governments have been. And some of those countries are ones that we may have thought would be those ones that would hold things closer to their chest because of their political or past performance in this area. I think the world has learned its lesson that hiding these kinds of things is worse for them in the long run, and that it's through good communication and then obviously strong science that we can actually stop these things faster. I have to say it's not just probably the goodwill and good intentions. It's also the world has moved on and it's different. We have Twitter, we have constant communication, and it doesn't really matter where you live. Things, the message will get out. People will share what's going on in their country, even if there are barriers against that. And so that's a motivating factor as well.
Dr. Mazet, was the One Health Institute and the PREDICT program involved in the recent Ebola outbreak?
So we did 23 outbreaks in the last 5 years, several Ebola outbreaks, but we were not involved in the West Africa outbreak. So when we started the PREDICT project 5 years ago, we had to get going. As you mentioned, these things are huge challenges and expensive. And so we did our modeling that said, where are the high-risk areas? And this exact point where the spillover event happened that started the West African Ebola outbreak was bright red on our risk map. It was a hotspot. We recognized it as a hotspot. But as we were getting started, the first 20 countries that were picked were also bright red in the hotspot map and aligned with where U.S. Agency for International Development was ready to make their initial investment. So we were not involved in those three West African countries where this outbreak really got going and continues. Hopefully slowing now, and we'll be under control really quickly. But we weren't working there, but we will be now. It's been added. So those new 14 countries I mentioned, those three countries as well as the others surrounding are now in that portfolio. And I guess this is where I think we'd like to go with the One Health approach, is to not have to be chasing the last outbreak and trying to help after the fact. The idea is to be proactive and to look at all of our information for this one, which would include where are those hosts living. We knew that the bats that could carry Ebola virus were living in that area. That was one of the reasons that area turned up red on our hotspot map. We also knew that there were changes going on in the agricultural and cultural systems in that area that put people at risk because they were interacting with animals.
And that's why you need the anthropologist, correct, to be part of this, to help predict what these people are doing and how they're interacting with wildlife?
Exactly. That's part of it. But we also, if you've been following that outbreak, we need the anthropologists because we need good community involvement. So the communities themselves don't hide their sick people. They actually want the help. They trust that the health system will be there for them. We need that public health infrastructure, and we need the community engagement that the anthropologists can help us with so that people become aware and they understand their behaviors and what put them at risk.
And I do, speaking of behaviors, I remember hearing that it was such a major problem because of the cultural norms that everyone wanted to touch the deceased person. And this was the norm for them to really embrace that dead person as such, the deceased. And now we're saying, no, we need to burn them. We need to destroy the body. And that was very difficult to get through to these people.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can imagine, if you take that one step further, if you see people in what look like moon suits coming at you, you know, if you saw a contagion, you know what those suits look like that we wear. You see people coming at you like that and want to take your sick baby away. And every neighbor that you've seen where those people have come and taken a family member away, those family members never came back. That's horrifying, right? I wouldn't want to do it either. But that's because we didn't have the community engagement. We didn't have the awareness that if you get to the hospital early and get fluids, about 60% will survive. And so that messaging, understanding what's out there and then understanding what the steps will be if you are sick and how you can hopefully recover, none of that happened because they were not expecting this disease in that area.
What I love about the One Health, you're talking about this collaborative effort, is that, okay, well, gee, this is interesting. I'm listening to this show right now on The Pet Doctor, but, you know, I have a pet. I'm not really interested in veterinary medicine or going into public health. I'm really into math. And math almost seems to be the cornerstone of what this PREDICT program is based on, the foundation of it.
Yeah, you know, I'm having a conference call right after we're done with this interview to talk about the math to help evaluate the risk of those new 900 viruses I mentioned. So we can't just say we have to keep looking for all 900, and the chances are that only one or two of those will ever spill over and make people sick. So we need to do the math to really help us come up with an algorithm to predict which one. Maybe we're going to look at the top 100 to watch the top 100 for any problems that might arise. But how do we figure out which ones are the top 100 of the new 900? And we need a lot of smart people and good math. And we pull together then ecological risk factors, epidemiological or health-related risk factors, as well as risk factors that are associated with the virus itself.
Speaking of risk factors, climate change. Some people believe it, some don't. I think it's pretty inevitable that people are going to realize, yes, our climate is changing. How much effect people's having on it? Some people will argue. What do you feel are the effects of climate change on infectious diseases around the world?
Well, you know, there's, in my mind, like you, there's no question that we are impacting our climate and that it's having some pretty dramatic effects now in our lifetime. The difficult thing when we talk scientifically about climate change is the scale at which these things happen, right? 1 degree over many years of warming. I think what we're seeing with both the climate change and the general trend for warming is drastic and dramatic climate variability. And I would guess that almost all of your listeners would acknowledge that since compared even to when they were children, climate seems more dramatically up and down. And that's part of what we want to look at. From a disease perspective, sometimes it is the diseases, those things that evolve more quickly, or even in insects that rapidly reproduce. That's where we can pick up those things in our own professional timescales during our lifetimes where we can see change. Our team here at the One Health Institute, for example, was able to detect that a new virus came into the Pacific Ocean. Now, it wasn't a new virus, but it came into the Pacific Ocean from the North Sea when there was a significant shrinkage and melting of the polar ice cap. So we saw marine mammals in the North Sea actually coming down into the Pacific Ocean that had never come into the Pacific Ocean in our historical time frame. And they brought with them, just like the Europeans to Native Americans, they brought with them some diseases that started making marine mammals in our Alaskan area of the Pacific Ocean really sick. So there is evidence that this climate change is having an immediate effect, but I think there's also evidence that it may be driving this increase in what we're seeing with infectious disease.
Kind of to wrap this all up right now, and I think we could go on for a long time, what do you think the future of One Health will be, and do you think veterinarians will be playing a larger role in the future of public health?
Absolutely. I think veterinarians are trained to look comparatively across many different species, including humans. So when we're learning about dogs and cats in veterinary school, we're learning how a dog and a cat are similar and where they're similar and different from a bird, and it makes us perfect One Health practitioners. When we come together with folks in human health, as well as all of those other disciplines that we mentioned in this interview, that's where we can really solve problems. And we've seen time and time again when we go off into our own silos and we only work, for example, on pet health, or we only work in agriculture, like a market for chickens, we aren't fixing the problem because we aren't thinking about the economies and what drives people to behave the way that they do. So I think the veterinarian, because of the systematic and comparative training, will continue to be leaders in this One Health sort of movement.
And thank you again for doing all that you're doing. I'm speaking right now with Dr. Jonna Mazet. She is the director of the One Health Institute at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Mazet, if people wanted to learn more about One Health, where can they go?
They can go right to our website. If they want to know about the PREDICT project, they can just type predict.global, and that will take them to all of the information about what we're talking about today, and they can also link out to our One Health Institute and our great Wildlife Health Center that lives within it.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate all your hard work. Hopefully your immune system stays up really good.
Thank you so much, and thanks to all your listeners for their interest.
So you've been listening to The Pet Doctor. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz on Pet Life Radio. Please listen again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. If you have any questions, suggestions for shows, please drop us a line and I'll try to address it. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.